No, non dire nulla. C'è la notte che parla.
Cosa sei?
La romantica notte.
Non cambi mai, non cambi mai, non cambi mai.
Tu sei il mio sogno proibito.
Proprio mai.
È vero, Speranza.
It's the Mega Vitamin edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, returning host emeritus, Ethan Clow. Let's begin episode 227.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and this is Don, your political science philosopher. Returning this week is Ethan Clow. Say hello, Ethan.
Hello, everybody.
So, this week we're going to start off with a bit of a rant, and it's nothing too big this week, but, you know, I'm just really, really pissed off with Canadian technology. I mean, so many times, Canada's had something really, really great. Let's go back to the Avro Arrow, there was Nortel, there have been a few others. You know, we were powerhouses. Let's remember Hudson Bay Corporation, a Canadian corporation that was one of the biggest in the world. Elcan, huge. And bunch of businesses that we were huge in has gone down the drain. And just recently, of course, BlackBerry has tanked it. It has not only sort of died, but nobody even wants the carcass anymore. And it's just really, really depressing as a Canadian. And to add to that, there's been a recent survey that was released that says that the one thing that we always identified as being Canadian is hockey is on the steep decline. It is no longer sort of Canada's number one pastime sports. Apparently even golf now is more, people play more golf than they do hockey, and I mean, it is expensive, I guess, to a certain degree, but I mean, Jesus Christ, we're Canadians, we gotta hold up the thing. Next thing you know, we're not gonna be drinking beer, there's gonna be no back bacon, and this poutine stuff will be something the Belgians invented and not us. Ethan, do you have any thoughts about, you know, the state of the Canadian identity, technology?
Well, I've never been a big fan of BlackBerry. I do remember the fiasco when the owner of Basile, tried to buy an NHL hockey team and sort of ran into the American stubbornness of Gary Bettman. But, I mean, speaking of hockey, I mean, the season, I think, is starting tonight. So I'm sure we'll see a resurgence of patriotic Canadian hockey zeal in the next few weeks.
Well, you know, I wonder if the two are somehow connected. Because, I mean, one, you know, if he had got his team in Hamilton, which he was truly trying to get done, one, that would have been a boost for the Canadian spirit, and we would have another hockey team. And maybe they would have put their attention then, having got the hockey team, back on the phone, so they didn't fall behind in that kind of technology. If they had got their franchise, it might have saved BlackBerry.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, if they had the naming rights to the stadium and they had that source of revenue coming in, you never know what could have happened. But maybe in the future we'll see a resurgence of BlackBerry. I mean, everyone wrote off Apple when Steve Jobs left, and you know, you look at some companies that have nearly bit the bucket. Nintendo floundered for so many years when Sony and Microsoft came on the scene. Now they're doing quite well, so you never know.
True. I think one of the things we have a problem with here is being a relatively small nation, we get one biggie, whereas larger nations like the U.S., Japan, China, they have seven. So if six of them end up failing, they still have sort of the one continues on. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to start off today's show with the thing about megavitamins. Okay, so I'm going to talk about how we basically over-medicate ourselves with regards to vitamins. Now, I'm not saying that vitamin supplements are not always bad. In parts of the world where there's a balanced diet is unavailable, supplements make sense. There are people, myself included, who have specific medical conditions that prevent proper absorption of vitamins. So again, supplements make sense. So please, no straw men. So I was reading an article a little while ago by Paul Offit about how, you know, we consume way more vitamins than we really need, and to the point where we're actually beginning to overdose on these vitamins, and it's becoming dangerous. Now, some people remember Paul Offit, because he's quite familiar in the skeptic community, for being the front man for the anti-vax movement. Now, the primary originator...
For the anti-vax movement.
Yes, sorry, yes. The
Poloff is a good guy.
Yes, right. So, the anti-vax movement, or the
No, the pro-vaccine movement.
Pro-vaccine. So, the primary originator of what we now call megadosing of vitamins lays at the feet of one person, Linus Carl Pauling. I hate to blame it all on him, but he's the person who had the stature, the knowledge to really make this thing go. Now, I should stop and point out that Pauling was in his lifetime actually a great man, a humanitarian, and a scientist. He won, in 1954, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for discovering an entirely new chemical bond. I mean, wow. And this was based on work he had published in the 20s. Having revolutionized physical chemistry, he then was part of the team that discovered the structure of protein in the 1930s. In the 1940s, he helped prove that abnormally folding proteins cause sickle cell anemia. And he won the 1962 Nobel Peace Prize for his work against nuclear weapons, testing. In fact, Pauling is the only person to win two solo Nobel Prizes, one in chemistry and one in peace. All these early discoveries were accompanied by proper scientific investigation. For some unknown reason, at the age of 65, that changed. Now, an armchair psychologist, such as myself, feel that maybe Pauling was somewhat suffering from an inflated ego, that he could do sort of no wrong, and that in almost every endeavor, he used unconventional or radical thinking to prove to make his new discoveries that were missed by others. One might excuse what I'm about to say, that he had a personal precedent in his mind when he was promoting these ideas that were not supported by the establishment. So he had sort of a track record of being the guy out there promoting things that everyone says, oh no, that can't be true, that can't be true. Pauling got some anecdotal evidence that large doses of vitamin C could increase his life expectancy by 25 years. Pauling tried it, and he felt better, which is your typical anecdotal evidence. I mean, if you try anything new, usually you have a, hey, you know, maybe this is really kind of working. I'm feeling great. Unless it's botulism, in which case it probably wouldn't work. But it also ran so he promoted this, he started to promote this, but it ran contrary to studies that had already been done in the 1940s that it showed that there was no benefit. It's unclear why Pauling seemed to, in his waning years, sort of abandon the scientific method, the very thing that had created his career. When people said that his ideas were nuts, that the method proved them wrong and him right. But by the 1960s, until his death, it was not so much the method, but his own personal belief that seemed to make things true. Any thoughts on that, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it's kind of an old story in this sort of field when you have somebody who's so close to a theory and they identify that theory as part of them. And any criticism of that theory is de facto criticism of them. So it's like they just perceive it as an attack on their person.
Oh, it gets better in that regard. Mm. So just a bit more. Of course, when Pauling started praising vitamin C, so more people did research, you know, proper controlled studies, and again, no effect was found. We should remember, Pauling was sort of worshipped as a genius. If he said something was good, people, scientists, wanted to believe it. However, the scientific methodology has no room for the cult of personality. There have been a dozen large-scale studies, experiments, and they show no link. But then, of course, Pauling doubled down, and he started to claim that it cured cancer. This was based on a small study done in Scotland that, when unbiased scientists took a look at the study, they noted that the vitamin C was given to people who were actually healthier to begin with, which is, I mean, a big oops. One of the foundations of valid double-blind scientific studies that can prove things is that the subject groups are equal. One could say that smartphones promote good health because people who use them have less medical issues. This, of course, ignores the fact that the majority of young, healthy people have the smartphones on them, while the sort of ill and infirmed elderly are less likely to adopt new technology. Again, based on the reputation of Pauling, which it was rapidly declining at this point because of these quack medical claims, scientists test the effectiveness of vitamin C on cancer, and again, no connection was found. Pauling, in classic quack science mode, when he could not get peer-reviewed science journals to talk about his miracle cure, he wrote his own book, Vitamin C and the Common Cold, and went on the talking circuit, directing people to take as much as 3,000 milligrams of the vitamin, 50 times the recommended dose. And I note I say talking circuit as opposed to lecture circuit, because this idea had already been debunked in the scientific or intellectual sort of areas. However, the popular press is always open to a charismatic talking head. Again, in classic Wu medical mode, he did not accept the that science contradicted his beliefs, and he lashed out at the studies against him as shots at him personally, that they were cases of, quote, fraud and deliberate misrepresentation. He even tried to sue some of the scientists. The dissent continued when Pauly started to claim that vitamin C plus vitamin A, E, beta-carotene, selenium, that this cocktail, what we would now sort of call just a multivitamin, could cure almost anything. By the time of Pauling's death in the 1990s, vitamin supplements were a big business. One plant in Texas churns out 350,000 tons a year of beta-carotene alone. In 1992, Times published a cover story, The Real Power of Vitamins. New research shows that they may help cure fight cancer, heart disease, and the ravages of aging. And essentially, they were just parroting Pauling's unfounded and disproven claims. Big supplements loved it. The National Nutritional Food Association distributed copies of this to every member of Congress. They described it as a, quote, watershed event in the industry. They had a major publication, Time, uncritically stating that megadoses of vitamins will, again, cure almost anything without any valid or scientific verification or evidence. It was anecdotal from top to bottom. It's ironic that in 1994, a law was passed that loosened regulations on vitamins because they were not, according to the law, seen as medicine, which again is just incredibly contradictory. The deregulation, of course, was great for big supplements, and the industry skyrocketed. If the medical value of vitamins were, well, valid, then the industry should have pushed for medical validation. By having them deregulated and put in the same class as you would, I don't know, pork or something like that, well, you know, it's just flim-flam of the industry. Its claims and its proponents seem obvious. If it's medically good for you, you want to be classified as medicine. If it's quack, then you want it to be classified as something like a spice. So, Ethan, I'm going to go on a little bit later about some of the actual harms that can be done. But, I mean, this is classic sort of woo science at best that we've heard from so many different kind of claims.
Yeah, and it's sort of one of those classic stories as well in the skeptic community. I mean, multivitamins have been, I think, pretty thoroughly debunked. In fact, the idea that they're universally good for you, anytime you hear someone say, this is universally good for you, usually means it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that you could have something that cures cancer, heart disease, and reverses the aging process is a pretty big red flag. I mean, you might as well just have the Fountain of Youth.
Oh, yeah, and I don't have it handy, but when I was going through the things that was claimed, I mean, it was far beyond just those three or four things. I mean, really, literally hundreds of things it was claiming to cure. And you hear about this so many things. Now, someone will say, well, sort of, what is the harm, right? Well, let's go into this.
Ask your liver.
Yeah, well, high doses of beta-carotene and vitamin E have been seen to cause cancer. It will increase the number of cancer cases in smokers, right? And again, these are the double-blind scientific studies, not, hey, Bob was taking multivitamins and he died of cancer, therefore it must be true. Similarly, vitamin A is linked with some forms of lung cancer. A study of the Pauling cocktail that was done in 2004 showed that gastrointestinal cancer mortality was up from those who didn't take Pauling's advice. In 2005, the Journal of American Medical Association pointed out that patients taking megadoses of vitamin E were at a higher risk of heart failure. In 2007, men who took multivitamins were twice as likely to develop prostate cancer. Ooh. 2008, a study involving 200,000 people found vitamin supplements increased the risk of cancer and heart disease. A 2011 study saw actually two studies were published. One showed that older women who were taking multivitamins, including there was a mineral supplement, died at higher rates than those who didn't. A second study showed that there was a 17% chance an increase of prostate cancer if you took vitamin E, again, reinforcing the previous study, which is how proper science is done. In 2010, just for reference, because everyone says, ooh, you know, you're the big shill. Well, the big shill here in this case is the vitamin industry, which grossed to $28 billion. And, you know, like, there are so many different ailments that can be caused by overdosing on that. I mean, we talked about some of the diseases, but in vitamin A, if you have too much of it, it can cause vomiting, abnormal vision, constipation. Constipation is common on these ones. Vitamin C does it. Vitamin B can cause nerve damage to your arms and your hands if you take too much of it. So sort of, I guess, my ending point in this, and if I'm going to paraphrase Mackenzie King, vitamins if necessary, but not necessarily vitamins. I mean, the translation, eat a well-balanced, well, okay, screw it. I mean, in Canada, even a half-assed balanced meal is good enough, and leave the supplements for those few people who really do need them.
Yeah, I mean, if your doctor says you have a deficiency in X, Y, or Z, then you go, okay, now I'll take these vitamins. But I mean, like you said, there's really no need. We're a half nation. If you're eating a fairly good diet, I mean, even like a McDonald's Happy Meal is probably going to give you enough vitamins to get through your day. You don't need to supplement them with a mega vitamin or who knows what else you're stuffing down your throat with those things. I mean, it's not necessary for your health.
Well, and a lot of these vitamins are actually, you get it, even if you don't eat the vitamin directly, they're precursors you eat in your regular thing. So if you have a certain amount of fat or something like that, you can actually produce these other vitamins internally, as long as you have a reasonably healthy caloric diet. That's why a lot of people in third world countries not only get ill because they don't have, you know, the proper balanced meal, but they don't have enough food in general to make some of the vitamins that they normally would be able to produce internally, if only. Like, I mean, vitamin E comes from sunlight, right? Okay, so Vancouver, maybe that's not the best example in the world, but we'll see. Anyhow, we're going to go to a quick commercial break, and we will be back after this.
CITR is proud to sponsor the Vancouver International Film Festival showing of Bill Morrison's film The Great Flood. Weaving together compelling archival footage of the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, complemented by an original score by Bill Frisell. That flood led to an exodus of sharecroppers all heading north. The result? Chicago blues, rhythm and blues, and ultimately rock and roll. For showtimes and information, visit vif.org.
And we're back. Now, there's been a lot of talk lately, especially with the lighting of the Olympic flame in Greece just last week, about a new law in Russia that would essentially open up homosexuality as a crime. The law itself cloaks itself in the garb of protecting children. One can only assume that there's some for assuming sexual abuse, which in itself is kind of offensive. It prohibits the spread of, quote, propaganda of non-traditional sexual relationships to minors. Now, first off, Russia, being part of the European heritage, must acknowledge that thanks to the Greeks, among others, that sexual relationships, especially with minors, was not only proper but considered an important part of the upbringing of a healthy child. Now, don't get me wrong, I am not equating homosexuality with pedophilia, which Russia is obviously doing. I'm not advocating that we return to the grand old Greek days where every adult finds himself a young kid and teaches him, in quotes. But if you're going to say it's traditional, well, this is what traditional often means. When people talk about traditional marriage, they don't mean the kind of marriage that we currently have, because things were a lot better. So in one sort of sense, homosexuality kind of is traditional. For the moment, let's accept sort of their sort of bigoted perspective. So what qualifies then as propaganda? The wording is actually very vague, and can be used to criminalize things like holding hands in public that could be construed as promoting a, quote, alternative lifestyle to children. Now, this regressive and barbaric law, and it is a large step backwards for Russia. Homosexuality itself has been allowed, at least legally, since the fall of the Soviet Union, and a similar bill was defeated in 2009. The current bill was passed on the 11th of June of this year, and shortly afterwards, four Dutch tourists who were filming a documentary on the state of human rights in Russia were arrested for talking to a group of teens, spent the night in jail, and were promptly sent home. A lot of irony in that one sentence. The number of people, groups, and activists who have been pushing for a more aggressive, response to this bill. A number of people have called for a boycott of Russian travel and Russian products. Perhaps the most notable one was the movement over the Stolenitsa, vodka. Well, actually, really, any Russian vodka. Stolenitsa get singled out because it sort of came out and said, well, listen, we're not really Russian, and we actually kind of support the LGBTQ community. Although, of course, it does so only in countries where it's sort of safe to do so, so I'm not sure if that's really supporting. Now, from what I've been able to learn about the particular company, it's kind of interesting, and it gives an interesting insight into the global interconnectivity of the world. So it's distributed out of Belgium. Its holding company is in Latvia. That said, it is distilled in Russia, and it's labeled all over itself as Russian vodka. And it has yet to decry the Russian laws or actively support Russian gay groups. The other big boycott proposal is the Olympic Games. There has been a long but not very deep history of boycotts of the Olympics dating back to 1926. Well, to be fair, the 1926 boycott was of Irish athletes who were protesting that the Irish team did not represent the entire Ireland because it excluded Northern Ireland, which was considered part of the British team. The next big boycott was in 1936, big in quotes, was 1936 Olympics in Berlin. Now, I'm not quite sure why that would have been controversial. Any ideas why 1936 would be controversial?
What was going on in Berlin in 1936?
Okay, so obviously it's Hitler, the Nazis, and the whole inferior people sort of thing. And we mustn't mention the war. Which actually, I guess there wasn't a war at that time, but I digress. There were plans to hold some... was plans to hold an alternative game in Barcelona, Spain, the runner-up for the 1936 Olympic bid. But this fell through when Spain declared a few months before to have a civil war instead of the games. They said, well, sports, and we'll go with the war. No, Spanish people are funny. Now, a number of countries almost boycotted, but ultimately did show up. So basically no national boycotts, but a number of individuals did choose to stay at home. Well, technically one nation may be seen to have boycotting, and that was Spain, who did not actually send a delegation to the Berlin Games. But again, boycott or too busy with the Civil War to send people. It was not until the 1956 Games in Melbourne that a real boycott happened. Actually, there were three boycotts. Buy one, get three free. Netherlands, Spain, and Switzerland refused to attend because of the repression of Hungarians by the Soviet Union. Cambodia, Egypt, Iraq, and Lebanon boycotted the Games because of the Suez Canal. And the formerly communist China did not attend because Taiwan was allowed to attend as, quote, the Republic of China. There was a threat of a boycott of African nations at the Munich Games if South Africa or Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe, yes, that's Zimbabwe, if these nations were allowed to participate over their opposition to national apartheid. They did boycott the Montreal Games because New Zealand was allowed to participate. Why New Zealand? Well, apparently the New Zealand rugby team played a game in South Africa, therefore supporting apartheid. Oh yes, and the two Chinas did not attend because, again, they could not agree on who was the real China. Now, perhaps the most famous and definitely the largest boycott was the 1980 boycott of Moscow Games in protest of the Soviet invasion, support, depending on your perspective, their intervention in Afghanistan. There was also this was so large because President Jimmy Carter was desperately attempting to hold on to the presidency at the time and bullied a number of nations, including Canada, to ultimately boycott the games. Ultimately, 65 nations didn't actually show up. Not to be outdone, the Soviet Union boycotted the following games in L.A. There were calls to boycott the Beijing Games in protests of, well, many things, most prominently being human rights in Tibet, but nothing much came of this. What do you think about the history of boycotting the Olympic Games?
Well, it's interesting that if you look at the boycotts that have occurred, they were all done for relatively unrelated political things. So face-saving tactics or, you know, in the case of like China or South Africa, you had international political gamesmanship going on that they were trying to make a point by. It's interesting that there haven't been more boycotts because it seems like it's a good way to snub another nation. Mm-hmm. And you think that more would have taken advantage of that. But, you know, the funny thing is, and I thought if there was ever going to be a major boycott and, you know, of the Olympics in, I guess, my life, it would have been in Beijing. The fact that there wasn't, I thought was really surprising. And I think that's probably going to be the norm from now on.
Yeah, I think I would agree. And I mean, obviously, if China can get away with what it's doing, it does seem to be kind of odd that, you know, we wouldn't allow Russia to do what it's doing, as horrible as it is, because there sort of is the precedent being set.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing too that's, I guess, depressing if you really want to look at it at this level, you can't really name a country or city that's hosted the Olympics in the last, well, I mean, they've only been going on for so many, couple decades. But I mean, every nation that's done it has some egregious human rights violation under its belt. I mean, if you look at Canada, the treatment of First Nations, if you look at, well, America, the same thing, Russia, China, all these countries have really dirty secrets in the closet that, you know, you would think that somebody would have said, hey, why are we going to this country to play games when they have this dark history?
Well, and going by the early ones, like the Melbourne one and the Montreal games, it had nothing to do with the host nation. Mm-hmm. It was other countries attending. And you would think, you know, and again, I'm not promoting this idea, but I mean, if Israel is going to the games, why are any Arab countries sending their contingency? You know, I mean, if you were going to make a point, you know, it doesn't even have to be with the host nation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of been the more of that has happened than with the host nation. More countries have said, oh, you're inviting him? Then I'm not going. You know, it's this political gamesmanship. I guess the only real exception has been the Soviet-American boycotts. You know, you crash our party, we're going to crash your party.
Well, and that was, I think, very much a tit for tat. And I mean, Jimmy Carter was desperate to do something. Yeah. He was seen as weak, especially with the Iran hostage situation sort of in the background. And so, again, not done for ethical or moral reasons. But ironically enough, the most powerful or no, the biggest boycott ever. I'm actually really kind of curious to know what's going to happen with the Tokyo Games in 2020, because I've been hearing a lot of news about people being overly concerned or underly concerned about Fukushima and mm-hmm. the nuclear power plant. And I mean, that raises up a whole other issue about nuclear power, which maybe we'll discuss later on. But I'm wondering if any nations are going to sit there and say, hey, we're not going to send our people because we're worried about the health situation.
Well, I mean, even I believe it's Brazil has got the summer games, right?
Yep.
Not that I have anything against Brazil, but it's not exactly the safest country in the world.
No.
I mean, so if it's a matter of pure, I'm worried about my personal safety, there are a lot of countries that you kind of cross off that list of places that I'm going to go. Now, the funny thing about, well, not funny, but the interesting thing about the Olympics happening in Russia, the IOC has been almost painfully unwilling to make any sort of statement at all regarding this. They have been so stubbornly refusing to even acknowledge there's a problem that it's, I think, driving on a lot of people to boycott or send letters or petitions to the IOC. And I think, unfortunately, the IOC has got its fingers in its ears and will not listen.
Well, actually, that leads on, because it's actually been pointed out that maybe instead of a boycott of the games, a gesture that Russian people would never know about thanks to sort of the renewed authoritarian regime currently controlling the nation. Some have, and I guess I would count myself as part of that, that what we could do is to encourage athletes to protest at the game. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, one of the greatest gestures of sort of FU at the Olympic Games back in 1936, the Nazi Games, was when Jesse Owens won his Olympics, basically proving to the world, and more importantly to the German people, that blacks were not an inferior race. Mm-hmm. During the 1968 Mexico Games, John Carlos and Tommy Smith helped raise awareness of racism in the U.S. by giving the Black Panther salute on the podium. I would love to see, you know, medalists kissing on the podium, you know, when they won the medal, wearing rainbow flags, carrying signs of support during the March of Nations, you know, trying to sort of get arrested. There's been a bit of mixed messages over who may be subject to the law during the Olympics. The IOC stated that it had assurances that the athletes would not be arrested during the game. However, the Russian Minister of Sports said that they would be. And no one yet, of course, has mentioned anything about tourists who may be attending the game, which is going to be another huge thing.
Yeah.
So if I was going to go to Sochi, I would stop by sort of my pride office, load up in a bunch of propaganda, quote propaganda, bring up a gay friend if you've got one, and let's see just what happens if the Russian government starts arresting Western citizens over the issue. We, here in Canada, the U.S., and Europe, have sort of a privileged place in the world thanks to our economic power, our colonial history, and our sort of sense of self-importance. Well, why don't we use that sort of sense of privilege to do actually some good? So, I don't know, pack your bags, we're off to the Olympics?
Well, I mean, the downside to that is, you know, how The thing is, it's kind of calling Russia's bluff, isn't it? It's like saying, okay, I'm going to wear a rainbow flag. What are you going to do about it? And if they do arrest you, I mean, you're going to spend a couple nights in jail before your nation can lodge a formal complaint. I mean, that's pretty risky. I don't want to spend, 4 hours in a Russian jail. I mean, before they ship you off to Siberia or something. It's a very dangerous game to play, and to a certain extent, I kind of think that the Russians want that to happen. They want a chance to rattle their sabers and act like the tough guy. They want to create this intense political problem.
See, I don't know if I would agree with that, because, I mean, Russia wants to elevate its status in the world, and it wants to say, listen, we're a strong, proud nation. Nobody can kick us. I mean, the recent stuff that happened in Syria is great proof about how Russia is willing to step up in a bad way to defend its neighbors, to say, listen, we're not going to get pushed around by, the Americans. Mm-hmm. That being said, if they start arresting Americans, British, Canadians, Germans, Japanese, that's going to have economic impacts on them as well, because, Russia is trying to be good partners economically with other nations. One of the reasons why you have the Olympics is to elevate your nation among other nations. And I don't think that we would stand for it. I mean, The Americans might, because they're a little dodgy when it comes to the whole gay thing in the first place. But the other hand of it is, okay, let's say you spend a few nights in a Russian jail, which is not a nice thing to do. If you go on the internet and you look at the persecution that is going on right now of homosexuals in Russia, bloody beating, killing, death, torture, a small price to pay, for a morally right stance. And granted, everyone has to make this choice. I don't think, everyone is right for this job. But I do think that there are people who in the world who are willing to risk their own personal safety for a greater cause, a greater good.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, if that's how certain people are going to protest, I mean, that is an option. One of the things that I've heard repeated before about this particular topic is that a lot of activists in Russia need the Olympics as a venue to protest. Because if they don't have the Olympics, there's not going to be international media. And when the Olympics are there, they have that opportunity to get in front of a camera. And so a lot of the activists were saying, we don't want to cancel the games. We don't want people to boycott the games. We want everybody to come and see. And, if you look at Vancouver or London as an example, it's very hard to get in front of those cameras if you're a protester. But, if you can do it, it sends a powerful message. And if you can find, I doubt that American media will, and I think Canadian media is ultimately too cowardly to do this as well. But I mean, if you get a country that does want to stick it in Russia's face, perhaps Germany, perhaps Britain, and is willing to showcase some of the protests, and I'm not saying that I want to see this, but if a gay kid gets beaten up on camera, that's going to send a really powerful message. Yeah. And again, I'm not saying if you're gay, don't go get beaten up, because you may get killed.
Yes.
But
no, but you're pointing out that a lot of this is abstract to a lot of people, and this would make it very real to them.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think another thing too, and I think the Russian activists believe this too, is that if the Russia is going to broadcast the games, there are opportunities in the games that will essentially force them to spread the message. If the athletes themselves, that's why the athletes are kind of an important mix in this, because the athletes themselves start advocating during the games, and they can't block some of that out anyhow. So the Russian people will see that there is an issue to be had here.
Yeah. The only problem with the athletes doing it is the IOC also has a history of banning players from making political symbols. You mentioned the Black Power salute. Those athletes were, I believe, banned for life from ever appearing at an Olympics again. So, I mean, it is professional suicide if you do make a political gesture during the games.
Good thing I'm not an Olympic athlete.
I know.
We'll be back after a little break.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Freethinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Freethinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. Ethan, you may or may not have heard, but there's a new game that was just released last week. I know at the place that I was working at, they opened up at midnight to sell this particular game. On its first day, it made $800 million.
Lee Marvin's Putting Palace.
How did you know?
Oh, I know. I'm hip with it.
So this, of course, is Grand Theft Auto V, which, according to reviews, has over 100 hours of actual gameplay. My God, how can you play that game for 100? Okay, I'm not that kind of a gamer, so I won't criticize it. But the game has started off with controversy on day one. There had been muggings for people to get the games. Ethan, you were saying you heard something about shooting.
Yeah, there was a fairly high-profile mass shooting. I don't know exactly its timeline with the release of the game, but I do recall that there was sort of that ongoing conversation, once again, of, you know, violent video games lead to violence in real life. Now, I think that the shooter in this case was a, you know, deranged person and obviously very tragic. I don't think it had anything to do with the game, but as you mentioned, there have been like person-on-person violence, people getting beaten up for the game, muggings, that sort of thing. And it has led to this kind of conversation popping up once again. You know, are these horrible video games corrupting the innocence of our children?
Well, thing? Are they?
Well, I don't play the game, but I would wager that it's not. I would wager that, honestly, if we're going to talk about media corrupting our values, I think that, you know, maybe there's a really popular TV show about meth.
Before we go there, I think one of the interesting things that we could do, again, as sort of a scientific study, is to see what was the rates of crime before the release of Grand Theft Auto V and afterwards, and was there an uptick, and is there correlating factors like other things? But yeah, we were talking about before the show, which Ethan horribly alluded to, sorry, Breaking Bad has finally ended its run. Dexter ends its run this year. There's another one that ends this run this year, but I can't think of what it is off the top of my head. Couldn't have been that good of a show. But one of the interesting trends that these shows sort of show is how the idea of the iconic hero, of course, they don't call Walter White or Heisenberg a hero. He's the anti-hero. But he's the hero. He's that one everyone likes. The whole reason why you turn up Dexter, right. The same thing. How, you know, 20 years ago, you didn't have that. I mean, the closest thing I can think of to that sort of person would be J.R. Ewing from The Dallas, who was a really popular character, who was also a really bad guy. But even he wasn't, like, you didn't cheer for him like you do. Like, people were cheering for Heisenberg when he did all his murders and his horrible things.
Well, I mean, the only thing that I can think of, and this is more for movies, is like The Godfather, all those mafia movies that were really popular in those days. Things like Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction. You know, you are, to a certain extent, cheering for murderers and drug dealers and bad people. And it's kind of an interesting thing because I think it does sort of tie into the whole popularity of video games like Grand Theft Auto, in that it is this sort of fantasy for people to live vicariously through these bad people, whether it's Walter White or Tony Soprano or even like Jaime Lannister from Game of Thrones. It's this opportunity to pretend to be the bad guy too. You know, we've all been in a situation where we're in traffic or we get cut, someone cuts in line at the Starbucks and you just want to, oh, I want to beat that guy so bad, like Tony Soprano would, yep. You know? And it's like, ooh, I get to play that role. And the same thing with Grand Theft Auto. You get to play as, you know, a mafioso, drug dealing, car stealing dude. It's this kind of fantasy fulfillment.
Well, you know, actually, and maybe another way. So first of all, you actually bring up a really interesting sociological trend, how this had started like in the 80s and early 90s in the movies and has gravitated onto the TV screen, and how mm-hmm. that sort of movies will maybe be the cutting edge which makes me horribly worried because things like Star Trek Descent into Darkness, if that becomes the trend for TVs, it will be bad.
Well, it's funny. I bet you could actually even look at the demographics of the 13 to 15-year-old kids who went to see The Godfather, grew up to make the video games like Grand Theft Auto, maybe not 5, but Grand Theft Auto 1 or 2, you know, to act out their fantasies. And now it's permeated down the, you know, cultural and demographic ladder. And it's just sort of become this well understood desire that everybody wants to be able to act out these darker urges. And I think not necessarily, I think with malicious intent, like someone says, you know, oh, I really want to kill somebody, but I can't, so I'll grab a video game. I think it's more, I know this is going to sound cheesy, but I think it's more innocent than that. I think it's more about like dressing up for Halloween. We dress up like as goblins and ghosts and monsters. We don't dress up as, you know, Abraham Lincoln. Well, some people do, but I didn't.
Yeah, no. Actually, yeah, on a different take on that, though, I'm wondering if the whole idea of being a good person is no longer seen as being a good person. If you take two different lines on this. One, which is more obvious, the role of police and, you know, the security establishment. If you go back, you know, 20 years ago, 40 years ago, depending on what community you lived in, because obviously if you were in a minority community, your opinions may not have changed at all over the time. But for someone like me, a white male, you know, the police were a good thing. They went, they helped you out. They protected you from bad stuff happening. But now, and especially after 9/11 and the militarization of the police force, I'm more worried of the cops than I am of any bad guy now, because they seem to be much more of a overt risk to me than the other. Now, don't get me wrong. There are a lot more criminals out there, and I am, in reality, much more worried about a criminal. But I see more about how cops or politicians or good people are no longer the good guys. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who are tasering 80-year-old ladies because they parked in the wrong spot. They shoot people in buses that only had a knife and there's no one else in the bus. You know, how can you have a game about a good guy when the good guys aren't good anymore?
Well, part of the reason, and you're right, I mean, you look at how many cop shows are about bad cops. But I think one of the reasons is that our sense of drama has matured, culturally speaking. I've been watching a lot of old Doctor Who episodes because I'm a nerd.
Yeah.
And it's remarkably different, just the style of the story, that the Doctor always wins, the good guy always wins. It's very A leads to B, leads to conclusion C. Nowadays, we like intense drama. We want our characters to be conflicted and, like, wounded and broken inside. And we want them to, like, struggle through hardship and torment before they finally, you know, we don't want to see Superman anymore. We want to see, like, these tortured alcoholic from broken family heroes who struggle.
But that still doesn't explain the Dexter or the Boardwalk Empire or something like that, where it's not we have complex characters, because you can have complex characters and they still be the good guy.
No, right? I agree, but I think that it's the next level up. I think that we like our heroes these days gray. We like them kind of a little neutral, a little dark. And then there are those of us who like really dark heroes, like the Walter Whites and the Tony Sopranos of the world. We kind of like having these sort of alignment-y gray superheroes who at times kind of do the wrong thing or behave in sort of selfish or malicious ways. And I don't know, maybe that's a sign of the times, maybe that's maturing tastes, who knows? I mean, maybe that'll change. Maybe if a popular new entertainment comes along and sort of shifts the zeitgeist back around, we may go back to seeing, you know, Superman and Batman beating up villains and, you know, all that jazz.
Well, I wonder, so I said there was two ways to go. On the other way, I don't think people would think of it plausible right now if someone who was a union member going to work and having issues happen to them as something that would really happen and them get ahead in the world. Whereas you take someone like, the Walter White character, Heisenberg, right? Where the only way for him to do good, to make it in the world, is to go bad, to turn to crime, because you can't make it in this world. It's no longer a fair or equal society. I mean, the whole premise, really, of the whole show is, for his entire life, Walter White lived by the rules. He tried to be a good person. He paid his taxes. He did his jury. He did everything he was supposed to do. And in the end, he got screwed, mm-hmm. right? And then he says, well, I'm going to screw the world. And he becomes this rich kingpin of the underworld. And that a lot of people sit there and say, well, you know, I have my job every day and I'm not getting anywhere ahead. If anything, I might be even falling behind because I'm not getting paid enough and expenses are going up. And here's this fantasy of what if I just turned to crime? What if I became the bad guy? That's one way I could escape this world that I am now living in. And that has been a significant change, again, over the 30, 40 years. I think you wouldn't recognize as much, but if you watch a lot of shows in the 70s, you had real people in there, and they were the heroes, and they were the central characters. I don't think people believe real people really exist anymore, because everyone has been so downtrodden that the only way to make it in this world is to turn black.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can see the same elements represented in, like, Game of Thrones. You have the morally righteous, honorable character like Ned Stark. What happens to him? He dies in the first season. Mm-hmm. The characters that live on are the liars, the cheaters, the malicious characters. Again, like, we could say it's part of a new sort of pessimistic outlook on life, and most likely that's partly true. But I think also we could also look at it from the point of view that, to a certain extent, it's more interesting to watch. Like, I've never been a big fan of Superman myself. I find Superman dull. He always wins. He's invincible. Batman, now there's an interesting character. He's a damaged person. Right. He's lost his parents, and he's dedicated the rest of his life to make sure nobody suffers the way he did again. And he will do almost anything to make sure that doesn't... I mean, he is like... If he existed in real life, a rich billionaire who decides to go out and fight crime, you would, you know, call for the butterfly nets. Because, I mean, this guy is clearly mentally disturbed.
Right.
But that's more interesting to us than the sort of righteous hero. And it might just be that we got so much of the morally uplifting, positive outlook of, you know, the Star Treks and the Supermans that we've switched so far onto the other side that we want to see these really nefariously sort of bastard characters. And, but I mean, again, it could switch back. I think that there could be a reverse. We could start to see again, I don't know, the Superman movie that just came out, I can't remember if it was successful or I didn't see it. But, you know...
Proving your point.
Proving my point. But, I mean, even the Star Trek is a good example. You had the first couple of series of Star Trek were these really sort of positive outlooks on life. And the most recent series, the Enterprise series, kind of flopped. And I kind of wonder if maybe it's because audiences are not interested in seeing an overly overly optimistic vision of the future. We would prefer to see a dystopian version of the future, like Battlestar Galactica or something like that.
Didn't they blow up a planet in the latest one?
Well, the movie did.
You mean the TV series?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. But then, of course, the main actor kept going back and forward in time and people.
That was a really bad story arc for that show.
Yeah, but, yeah. You know. But so that leads then maybe to another question, sort of related, is what do you think about the whole idea that push versus pull? I mean, one of the things that tends to be happening nowadays is there's a move to distract people, to get them addicted to a certain extent. I mean, obviously that's what the business is. Mm-hmm. By providing for them the entertainment equivalent to crack cocaine. Or do you have the sort of idea that, hey, listen, people like dark villains. They like it when the bad guy wins. They like this sort of thing. So we're going to make more shows like that. Mm-hmm. So do you think this is more of a push, that this is what they think you should like, and they saturate the market with that sort of thing, and eventually one of them will hit? Or is it like, this is what the people are demanding, so let's go with it? I think one of the classic examples is the idea of reality TV. I mean, reality TV wasn't, I think, originally created so much from popular demand, but the companies that the TV producers say, listen, these things are super cheap to make. And if we make 50 different varieties of this reality TV show, even if only like 10% of them actually catch on, great. And in doing so, they've kind of created the whole genre now where everyone is expecting things to be kind of like a reality TV show.
Well, I don't know if I have a comment on that, but one thing that does occur to me is if you look at the last 5-10 years at the really acclaimed, critically successful TV shows, I don't think it's a coincidence that most of them are happening on premium cable channels. You know, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, etc.
House of Cards.
House of Cards on Netflix, which is a whole new thing, right? Versus, you know, normal cable TV or, well, whatever, basic cable, whatever we call that now. And it's funny. I mean, you look at before that, you had Seinfeld and Cheers and Frasier and MASH, huge, huge smash hit TV shows, critically acclaimed shows that appeared on basic cable. Like, when was the last time? I mean, the only one that I can think of maybe is Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, no, I'm at a loss.
Like, I mean, honestly, if someone said to me, what would you rather have, HBO or like NBC and CBS, and all, like, well, I'm going to go with HBO.
Yeah.
And I mean, perhaps part of that is the fact that they are tailoring their shows to a specific demographic. I mean, when The Sopranos first came out and I heard the cons, I was like, that sounds stupid. Right? Why would I want to watch a show like that? Then I watched it and I was like, oh my God. And now it's like, you look at HBO and the other premium cables, they're all these really edgy, lots of sex, lots of violence. And, you know, maybe not surprising, that has really caught on.
Yeah, actually, I've noticed in a number of new shows, especially the first season, they're like softcore porn and hardcore violence, just intermittent between each other. But it works. Like, Boardwalk Empire is one that comes to mind that sort of works there. But that also, I mean, it's not really a fair playing field in that regard, right? I mean, your criticism of quote-unquote basic cable, they have to provide a full spectrum of shows. So they have, like, they have the dramas, the comedies, but they also got to do the news and the public interest and all the other stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas an HBO can afford to put all of its money into high drama because it doesn't do any of these other sort of features.
Well, they do actually some pretty interesting documentaries. That was one of the things that I think is really neat about HBO, is that I think because they're The Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire and et cetera, are so successful, they can occasionally throw out a curveball. I mean, they've done some pretty interesting dramas, period pieces. The most recent one, about Liberace, was well regarded. They've done some pretty good documentaries on like music. If you ever want to watch like a concert documentary, HBO is a really good venue for those. I mean, some of the bands that have done like tours have been filmed by HBO, have done really good. So, I mean, they do have alternative programming. It's maybe not as popular, but I think that because they're just so successful, they're more willing to give an experiment a go. Whereas, you know, your NBC that's hemorrhaging money is not going to be like, an experimental TV show. No. You know, like, they're going to go with what we know works, and that is, you know, a couple dumb white people doing a half an hour comedy show.
You know, it's actually, and to back up that sort of idea, because if you go back to when like Fox first came out as the new alternative to the big three in the States, mm-hmm. one of the things they did was do a lot of controversial experimental type TV shows to sort of break out there. So it's the fact that they're more new than they were something special. I wonder if that sort of same aging feature will hit HBO, that in 10 years from now, they're going to do the safe shows and there's going to be some web-based, I don't know,
Well, the funny thing is, and I think you kind of are already seeing it with House of Cards and Netflix. I mean, the other show that springs to mind is Ricky Gervais's new show, Derek, which I don't know if you've seen it, but it's kind of a sad comedy.
Isn't it based on the he's a janitor, but he's also mentally handicapped?
He's like a maintenance, or no, he's a like a care worker in an old folks home.
Oh, yes.
It's like a totally non-marketable idea, but it's something that obviously Gervais really cares about. And when you have a venue that is willing to give you that kind of creative control, and another good example is Louis C.K.'s TV show, which is not on like Netflix, it's on Showtime or something like that, but they gave him an extraordinary amount of creative control. And it's a huge success. And the thing that's interesting is that other artists, other comedians are pointing at that and saying, that's what I want to do. He's figured it out. I want to be like that guy. And I think that to a certain extent, we could see a really interesting renaissance of quality entertainment. And there, actually, Louis is a great example of an honest-to-goodness, nice guy trying to do things. It's a hilarious TV show, and it's, you know, horribly awkward things happen to him. But he generally is a nice guy who's trying to do good by his daughters and help people. And I think that that's a really good example of some really creative ideas happening in you know, a changing environment of TV and, you know, blurring the lines between on-demand entertainment versus sort of just passive entertainment that you get from basic cable.
Don't you think, though, that in that kind of a world, it actually makes it harder for new people to come up with stuff? I mean, Louis C.K. is great, and Ricky Gervais, but, I mean, they're not your typical comedic writers. I mean, these are guys who became superstars and now parlayed that success to become, to do these personal projects, mm-hmm. which is great because if they create great things, I have no beef with that. But in doing so, money that might have gone to the smaller people isn't there because it's all been vacuumed out. All the air has been sucked out of the room by these bigwigs.
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, but again, I think I can't imagine that Gervais is getting a lot of money from a Netflix TV show. I just don't think that, because, I mean, the big money is going to be from either network basic cable, where they have the advertisers' cash, or they, you know, an HBO that's got a superstar hit like Game of Thrones or Boardwalk Empire or something. I'm kind of surprised actually that someone like Gervais is doing a Netflix show, because I mean he'd make more money doing a comedy tour.
No, but I'm yeah, okay, yeah. So one last comment, and we're gonna end the show, but I want to get your thoughts on this. So did you sign up to go to Mars?
I did not.
Over 200,000 people signed up to get on a reality-based TV show to become the people to be selected to go to Mars in, I think, 2035 was the year. Yes, 2023, which is amazing that many people, because, I mean, you had to pay to get in there, and it strikes me, and most people figure, I mean, they're never going to go. It's a one-way trip.
But just think of the ratings. It'll be skyrocketing.
Oh, yeah. Are you going to tune in?
Probably not. I'll be watching Game of Thrones.
Oh. Well, they did find some good news, though, that recently with the Mars rover has good news, bad news as far as life on there. So when they show up, then it's bad because there's no methane found. They thought there was methane to be found there. One of the English probes that circled the planet said, hey, we detected plumes of methane. The Crash rover says, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. We didn't find no methane. But they did find a shitload of water. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot. It's like 2% per kilogram.
But still, it's in the soil. But, I mean, nevertheless, that's pretty fascinating.
Well, and the way the soils work on Mars is because they have such high winds and all that, what you find in one place is pretty much representative of every place on the globe, at least for the surface level. And they figure that, I think, what is it, one kilogram of dirt will give you like 2 liters of water. So it's like, that's going to be great for them as far as that goes. Well, anyhow, we've reached the end of the show. Ethan, any last comments for our folks before we leave?
I hope to be starting some new projects pretty soon, and I will keep everybody informed via Twitter, Facebook, and, of course, Radio Free Thinker. So thank you, Don, for having me back on the show.
You're welcome, and I will remind people that Skeptic Camp is coming up in November. Check our webpage to find out when that's coming up. Please attend if you want to participate. There's always ways to help participate. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on. Uh-oh, I'm going to do a commercial first.
Discorder Magazine is proud to sponsor the Vancouver International Film Festival's showing of Tito on Ice, directed by Max Anderson and Helena Ahonen. A surreal tale in which graphic novelists cart along a macabre papier-mâché mummy of Marshal Josip Broz Tito, encased in a refrigerator, on a barnstorming tour of the former Yugoslavia. For showtimes and more information, visit vif.org.
From scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos.